I'm Claire McInerney, and welcome to Profiles on WFIU. On Profiles, we talk to notable artists, scholars, and writers and get to know the stories behind their work. Our guest today is Walt Bogdanich. He's an investigative journalist currently writing for The New York Times, but has worked for The Wall Street Journal, ABC News, CBS's 60 Minutes, and also teaches investigative reporting at the Columbia University School of Journalism. His investigative work has exposed malpractices in the tobacco industry, cover-ups in railway deaths, and followed how dangerous pharmaceutical ingredients from China ended up all over the world, just to name a few stories. Bogdanich's work has earned him numerous awards, including 3 Pulitzer Prizes. Walt Bogdanich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to kind of start off and talk about your work as an investigative reporter. The stories you report take months to report, including lots of traveling and time. Will you talk about how you choose the stories you decide to put so much effort into?
Well, investigative reporters have this view of the world that's a little different than everybody else. Everybody else can walk by a set of facts and see nothing wrong with them, see nothing out of place. We'll walk by a set of facts and we'll see red flags. So I'm just an astute observer of the world around me. There's a saying that I see often in New York City that's intended to alert just the average person to possible terrorist activity. And they say, if you see something, say something. If something doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. And that last phrase, if it doesn't feel right, is really the mindset of investigative reporters. If I look at something and it doesn't feel right, then I'm going to look at it. And I have sources who call me, but so many of my stories really come through my own personal experiences.
And have you always had that gut feeling of knowing when something is wrong, or is that something that's developed over your career? Because you've been doing investigative reporting most of your career.
Well, obviously, I've gotten better at it. Repetition does help. But it's always been part of me. Back when I was in high school, I would see things that I didn't think were right in how the school administration handled matters. And it bothered me. And so I guess I had that part of me that always looked at issues and was troubled by unfairness, by people who take advantage, powerful people who take advantage of less powerful people. And I've always wanted to do something about it. I've never really liked bullies, and being an investigative reporter helped me be in a position to do something about injustice and in a way that could lead to meaningful reform. So I love what I'm doing. I've done it for 40 years, and I can't say I'll do it for another 40 years, but I'll do it as long as I'm able.
So now that you're farther along in your career and you say people come to you with stories, do you have to be more selective? And if that's the case, how do you choose which one to really pursue and dig into?
I prefer not to focus on any one corrupt individual, as in one bad apple. I prefer to look at the barrel. And what is it about the barrel that is causing the apples to rot? I prefer looking at the system and how the system is not functioning properly. Because if you do that and you see where the weaknesses are, that is what can lead to reform, as opposed to throwing out one bad individual and another one might come in. So I tend to pick stories that will look more broadly at how, whatever the system might be, it might be the healthcare system, it might be the education system, how is it failing the public? And that's my orientation.
And all of the stories you write unveil these broad injustices that of some part of society, like you just mentioned. And investigative journalism, especially over other parts, can have incredible power once that information is revealed. Will you talk about, as the journalist behind those stories, what it's like to create change or, you know, have that power to inform people?
As an investigative journalist, particularly at the New York Times, you have extraordinary power to impact, you know, human events, really. With that, of course, you know, it comes a heck of a lot of responsibility not to misuse that. We do have power to do good, but when we do bad, we have the power to do bad, and we can negatively affect people's lives in ways that maybe we don't intend to if we're not careful. So, you know, it's incumbent on us to really make sure that we are careful and accurate and fair. And I have a lot of help in achieving those goals from my editors. It's teamwork is important in journalism, and I work for a good team.
I want to move to one of your stories from the 90s, but it got you a lot of attention and a lot of consequences. It was called Smokescreen. It was a TV piece you did for ABC News for a news magazine called Day One. And you were the producer, correct?
I was.
Because there was a different reporter. But it investigated the tobacco industry's practice of adding more nicotine into cigarettes, which at this time hadn't really been uncovered yet. People were focusing on other parts of the tobacco industry. Before we talk about it, I want to play a clip from that TV piece. And when we jump in, we're going to start with a soundbite from the former Surgeon General, Dr. C. Everett Koop. And eventually we'll hear the reporter, John Martin, talking to tobacco executives. So let's listen.
Well, as you described that, which I've heard for the first time, it makes my blood boil, because what they are now selling is not a natural tobacco product which happens to have nicotine in it, but they are selling a nicotine dispenser, and that is quite different.
To try to verify that nicotine is being added to the reconstituted tobacco in cigarettes, we went to the American Health Foundation, a respected research center in Valhalla, New York. At Day One's request, the foundation separated and then analyzed the reconstituted tobacco portion of several brands of RJR cigarettes. Reconstituted tobacco ordinarily contains 25% or less of the nicotine in regular tobacco. But the samples we tested had up to 70% of the nicotine that would be found in regular tobacco. Bogdan Prokopchik performed the analysis.
Now, I was kind of surprised because I expected it to be less. The most likely explanation is that some nicotine has been added either with flavoring agents or by itself.
Why are you adding nicotine to your cigarettes?
We are not in any way doing that.
You're not adding nicotine?
No, we don't do that.
Joseph DiBathese and John Robinson are RJR scientists involved in tobacco research.
You know about tobacco extracts, though.
I do know about tobacco extracts. They're used as flavor materials, and it's very common in the tobacco industry.
Is there nicotine in those?
A water extract of tobacco would have nicotine in it.
How much?
And just like a water extract of the coffee bean would have caffeine in it.
And, so would this be a little bit or a lot?
It's hard for me to say. I don't know what a little bit or a lot would be. But I think that...
Well, how much does it have?
I think any company involved in the manufacture of tobacco and whose consumers are demanding a wide range of tar and nicotine products, they have blending and reconstituted tobacco techniques for reaching those that range of tar and nicotine in their products.
So you faced some serious consequences after that story aired. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Well, let me explain a little bit more about what that story was. Until we did that story, reported that story, there was a belief, you know, publicly that, in fact, encouraged by the tobacco industry, that nicotine just came along for the ride. It was on the tobacco leaf. Our founding fathers harvested tobacco leaf and made cigarettes, and nicotine was just there, naturally there. And what we had found is that often the nicotine was not naturally there, that there was a process by which nicotine was removed, other adjustments were made, and then the nicotine was put back in the cigarette. So it was a question of intent. They could have taken the nicotine out, which is addictive. Of course, at that time, they were saying it wasn't. Later, they admitted that it is. So our story really cast a new way of looking at how cigarettes are made and why they're so dangerous. That's what was so frightening to the tobacco industry, because essentially we showed that they were marketers, not so much of tobacco leaf or cigarettes, but they were marketers of a drug called nicotine. Because if nicotine wasn't in cigarettes, people wouldn't smoke them. And so that was new. And they didn't like that, and they sued us for quite a bit of money. And, we had to deal with that.
You say quite a bit of money, though. It was $10
billion. It was $10 billion, and it was a ridiculous lawsuit, and they knew it. And it was filed, if I recall correctly, before the congressional hearings were held on the manufacture of cigarettes and nicotine. And this was the famous hearing where all the seven executives from tobacco companies raised their hand and under oath said that nicotine wasn't addictive and that smoking really wasn't dangerous. All of them were eventually, really in short order, moved out of their jobs because nobody really believed them. And so this was a shock and awe attempt to scare other journalists away from reporting on tobacco. That was the goal of filing a ridiculous $10 billion lawsuit.
How did you find out as a reporter that this is what was happening? Because it seems your story was this catalyst to rip the veil off of this industry of something that was happening.
It was one of the catalysts. There were others who followed and joined in the appropriate reporting on tobacco's dangers. But we got into it because of a whistleblower and who contacted an advocate for tobacco control advocate, who then passed it on to us. And it took us a year of reporting before we finally put it on the air.
And so how soon after your story aired did you start seeing changes in terms of the congressional hearings and things like that? I mean, you were also dealing with a lawsuit at the time, but did you do follow-up stories and whatnot too during that time?
Yes. Eventually, I mean, there were other news organizations that were reporting a lot on this. My company at the time was more frightened. Well, I wouldn't say frightened. The company was in the process of selling itself to Disney, and they didn't want a $10 billion lawsuit on the books when they were selling it, and they wanted it to go away. And they didn't want me to do any serious reporting on this problem. And so I came into possession of the most secretive cache of tobacco documents ever. And that's in the words of the FDA commissioner. And we had those that revealed the lies of the cigarette companies that they had been telling the public for years and years. And ABC News, in one of its worst moments, not the news division, but the corporate division, ordered me to turn over those documents and not to report on them. It was a shameful period in their history. And those documents, and I won't tell you how they ended up at the New York Times, but, you know, reasonable people can conclude on their own, ended up at the New York Times on the front page. They had no problems in publishing it. So there was a reluctance on the company's part because they were being sold to really support its news division. And I eventually did an hour after this of reporting on the tobacco industry, which I did with Peter Jennings, who was then the anchor. And after that, I left for 60 Minutes.
Will you talk about the position you were put in as an investigative reporter who feels called to expose injustices like this, and you had the information there, but you were being told not to do it and not to pursue the story. Is that kind of what pushed you out the door to find a different job, or how did you deal with those orders?
Well, I certainly didn't want to work for an organization that didn't believe in the principles that all good news organizations believe in, and that's to aggressively report the truth and then stand by the reporters who do that kind of reporting. ABC, in this case, did not out of its own self-interest. It was a shameful episode. And I know that a number of people over there regret that, shouldn't have done it. But it happens. They knew I had done nothing wrong, because they let me continue to work there and, in fact, gave me a raise. They knew it was nothing to do with the content of what we were reporting. It had to do with you know, the corporate lawyers and others who had other agendas other than the truth.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm Claire McInerney. Our guest today is Walt Bogdanich, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times. Another story I want to talk about is once you got to The New York Times, and it's from a few years ago. It's called Mangled Horses, Maimed Jockeys. And this is a really interesting investigative look at the world of horse racing. And maybe you can summarize your story a little bit before we talk about it, just so listeners can understand the context of this investigation.
Well, I knew nothing about horses or horse racing, but I was following the attempts to save a horse, Barbaro was its name, that had won one or two legs of the Triple Crown and then broke a leg. And they were trying, when a horse breaks a leg, pretty much they put the horse down because it can't survive if it can't stand up. And the whole world was rooting for this horse as it underwent operations and attempts to save its life. And in some of those articles, I noticed one fact that had been reported, which struck me as worthy of further examination, which was that horses break down at twice the rate in this country than they do in Europe. And I'm thinking, well, why is that? And as I looked into it, there were a number of issues that jumped out at me. Among them, the use of drugs, pain-killing medication, is much more tightly regulated in Europe than it is in the United States. So I wondered whether the over-medicating of these horses to keep them running was a factor in them breaking down. And so that's how I started working on that project.
And this story is fascinating because you can tell there's a ton of data that you were going through and a lot of information. Where did you – so you read this one line that horses break down much faster or more frequently in the United States. What was your process then? Did you start planning trips to racetracks or did you start collecting data? What was your process with this story?
I didn't go out to racetracks for a very long time. My goal in doing this story – and I wouldn't have done it if I didn't feel I could reach that goal, was to quantify the problem somehow. The reason that hadn't been done is because each state regulates horses according to their own rules. There was no national database of injuries or breakdowns. So I faced the problem of how do I, and a lot of these things aren't reported properly. So how do I go about figuring out how bad the problem is and where the problem exists more so than in other places? And again, I'm unfamiliar with horse racing, but I had looked at, you know, a racing form, and I noticed that there was a short description of every race that bettors need to factor in to, you know, whatever, which horse they're gonna pick to win or place or show. And so I noticed that there were these brief descriptions of that would indicate whether a horse was in trouble or broke down. And I went to our computer experts at the paper and said, is there a way we can go through the tens of thousands of these races and pick out these horses and who the jockeys were and who the trainers were and where they were when they had a physical problem? And they said, yeah, we can do that. So we bought, I don't know, it was 200,000, you know, races and data from it and scraped the appropriate information from there and put it into a database. And we were able to, you know, analyze what was happening. And, you know, we were able to find, for instance, that the most dangerous state for horse breakdowns was New Mexico. So my first real reporting trip was to go to New Mexico, to the track that had the highest breakdown rate. And on my first visit, in I think the sixth race, I watched a horse break down and throw the rider into the ground and break his neck. He's been on a respirator ever since. Wow. I mean, to see that happen so quickly. And then the next day, another horse broke down. It was, you could say I was lucky to be in the right spot at the right time to witness that, but in fact, it wasn't luck. It was a lot of hard work that directed me to the place that I needed to be.
I want to read the part of the intro to this story because I think it really captures how dangerous it is for these horses to be breaking down and why you were probably drawn. The second paragraph starts, 19 seconds later, under a brilliant blue sky, a national champion jockey named Jackie Martin lay sprawled in the furrowed dirt just past the finish line, paralyzed, his neck broken in three places. On the ground next to him, his frightened horse, leg broken and chest heaving, was minutes away from being euthanized on the track. For finishing fourth on this early September day last year, Jackie Martin got about $60 and possibly a lifetime tethered to a respirator. Through reporting this story, you kind of got to see what it's like to own horses, to train horses, to bet on horses. And it almost seemed like these jockeys were just vehicles to get these animals across the finish line for the money. What toll did that take on you visiting these jockeys who were on respirators or who were taking the chance? There's a line in your story about every time they get on a horse, they take a chance that this could happen.
They do. I mean, they're not responsible for these horses breaking down. The trainers and the owners are. A lot of them may have a sense when they get on them that the horse may have a problem. And if they're honest about it, they'll scratch the horse. They'll take it out. But if you start doing that too often, the owners won't hire you or the trainers won't hire you to handle their horses. So that's the problem. Talking to these jockeys was difficult. I mean, I was in the hospital room in Houston with Jackie Martin as he's on the respirator, and I'm asking him, would you do it again, knowing what's happened to you now? And he said, absolutely. He said, there was no experience like it than being on the back of a horse racing. This was his life. He knew the risks, he accepted it, and there's nothing he would do differently. That was an eye-opening interview.
One of the biggest takeaways I got from this story was the lack of regulation in this industry. Like you said earlier, each state does it differently. Some report, some don't. There's a lot of backroom deals in terms of hiding and pumping up drugs on the day of the race. Since this has been published, have you seen any changes with horse racing?
There were changes. How profound those changes are, I guess I'm not in a position to answer because I moved on to other topics. But initially, there were some reforms in New York State, and certainly in New Mexico, there were big changes. So yes, there have been improvements made, but horses continue to break down in unacceptable numbers. There are major powers in the horse racing industry that really benefit from the system working as it is and have fought changes. And that's unfortunate because these are incredible, noble animals. And to exploit them, to profit unfairly off their suffering, is just plain wrong. And you know, I love animals. I care about them. You know, I mean, sometimes I find Americans care more about animals than they do humans. So this story got a lot of reaction.
And you say you moved on to other stories and other topics. As an investigative journalist who spends so much time and gets to really dive into a story, is it hard to move on eventually, especially when you don't see broad sweeping reforms, kind of like after your smoking story? You saw congressional hearings, and so when you moved on, you knew you had made change. You know, with this horse racing one, it was a little different.
Well, there were changes. But after I've been on a story for months, a year or however long, I'm ready to move on. I mean, when I write a story, it's because I feel I've gotten to the point where I have something important to say. I have a hypothesis that I started out with and I'm able to prove. It's time to move on. And I don't want to become obsessed with just one topic. There are a lot of other areas that need exploration and reporting, and that's part of the thrill of being a reporter, is that every day is a new day and I'm always learning something and experiencing something new. So usually after I finish publishing a series of stories, enough is enough.
And this story made me think about, as a reporter as well, I think it's easy to become desensitized to an issue when you spend so much time and it's your job, and sometimes it hits you that this is bad, that this is happening, and I'm trying to tell this story. As someone who covers so many stories that would be easy to internalize, how do you deal with kind of seeing maimed jockeys say, I would do it again, and knowing how they got there, or, you know, knowing that the tobacco industry is manipulating people? How do you separate yourself from that work, or do you?
I don't. Investigative reporters share one common trait, and the most important one being that they have a low threshold of indignation. They see things that aren't right. They see people being exploited. They want to do something about it. It's painful to see the suffering, but I know that by reporting it and examining the causes of that suffering, that I'm going to help them. Maybe not even those individuals, but I'll help people in the future who may be injured by whatever I'm exposing. So I know I'm doing good, you know, and that's what motivates me. And you know, it sometimes it's a hard road to travel, but it's one I choose to go on voluntarily. And at the end of the day, I'm very proud that I work in a profession that really, you know, is so important in a democracy. I mean, I believe in our way of life here. I believe that people in a democracy need information. And I'm part of that process. I love our country. I love my profession. I couldn't, you know, looking back on my life, I really couldn't be more satisfied with how things have turned out for me.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm Claire McInerney. Our guest today is Walt Bogdanich, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times. We'll be back after a short break. So to talk about those Pulitzer Prizes that you've won, the stories you have won them for are of the similar nature of your other stories, but I want to hear from you, what made them different in your head as the reporter? Because obviously they resonated with people outside of, you know, the average reader, but also judges and whatnot. So what stuck out in your head when you were reporting them? Or did they?
Well, I don't think they were any different than any of the other stories that I've done. I mean, I try my best to turn out a story. Every one I do, I want it to be better than the last one. In the opinion of Pulitzer judges, these particular stories appealed to them, but there are other ones that I did that I thought were just as important. You know, as I said earlier, well, I mean, a lot of the stories come from my own personal experience. The medical, faulty medical testing in labs in the United States, you know, came out of my own experience in getting inaccurate lab test results. I wanted to know more. That led to, you know, a year-long investigation at the Wall Street Journal. When I was looking at railroad crossings, I mean, I came across that story simply because a pharmaceutical company came to visit the New York Times. And I thought they were going to be talking about, you know, problems with the FDA, or these were the issues they cared about. And much to my surprise, one of them said that their biggest issue was railroads. And I'm thinking, why do you care about railroads? Well, it turned out this company also was involved in chemicals and in other, you know, pesticides and other things, in addition to pharmaceuticals. And they had to use railroads to move their product from one point to another. And the railroads own those particular rail lines. And they felt that they were being asked to pay too much and they didn't have a free market in place. And so they mentioned that railroads are very powerful. And I had never heard that. I thought railroads had been dealt with by Teddy Roosevelt, you know, but, you know, so it was a surprise to me. And I decided if they're so powerful that they can intimidate and anger a major pharmaceutical company, maybe I ought to look at them and see what else is going on. And that's how I came across the, you know, the cover-ups of these fatal railroad crossing accidents. You know, as I said, it comes from just being an astute observer of the world around me.
Do you ever get pushback from your editors? I was watching another interview someone did with you, and you said railroads were kind of a tough sell to go and say, oh, well, I found all this stuff. Do you ever have them say, I don't know if this is what we wanted?
A lot of times.
Okay.
I mean, I tend to pick topics to look at that are in sort of the dark corners of society. I do that for a number of reasons. One of them is that I feel they've been ignored and others aren't looking at it. And another reason is that I try and avoid the topic du jour where everyone is looking at it and there's a feeding frenzy. The kinds of stories I like to do take a long time. I research for a long time. I don't publish for a long time. And if I'm covering a breaking type story where others are reporting, I may lose it before I get to the point where I feel I have something significant to say. So the nature of what I do is that I pick rather sometimes obscure topics. And editors initially are a little, you know, curious as to why. And they they come around. I've never run into an editor that won't publish a good story. And I've earned their trust. And they let me do what I think I should do. And that's a trust that's been built up through many years of working with them.
When you first started, how did you pitch these stories to your editors, maybe at the beginning of your career when you didn't have a track record yet of great stories?
Well, I took it seriously, and I remember a lot of how much success you have in convincing editors to do a story is how you present it. And I remember in some of my early jobs, other reporters would say, oh, why do you get to do those? I never get to do them. You get all this time to work on stories. And I'm thinking to myself, well, it's because of how I approach the editors. I don't ask them on the way to the food line or the cafeteria or on the way to the restroom, hey, I got this story. I don't present it until I have some serious, verifiable facts. Usually some documents that I can show them. So I make a presentation in their office when I was a young reporter and say, here's what I got. You should let me do it. And they see that it's not just he said, she said, maybe I'll get this, maybe I'll get that. It was a very high likelihood of success. And they bought into it. And the more you're successful at it, the more likely they're going to give you the green light next time.
So you have to convince editors sometimes, but will you talk about the techniques you have in trying to get people to talk to you? You know, how did you get tobacco execs to even sit down with you guys? Or you've done some sexual assault stories that I want to talk about in a little bit, but what are your techniques to getting people to talk to you?
Persistence and not taking no for an answer. And if one approach doesn't work, try another approach. And being the squeaky wheel, eventually someone's going to want to come over and oil it, you know, being a pest, you know, polite, but letting them know you're not going away. Let them know that it's going to be a lot less painful to deal with you than it is to be having to field my calls every day. Eventually, I'm able to convince them that it's in their best interest to talk because it's important for their view to be in the story. And ultimately, that wins the day.
So I want to switch to some of your recent work, which, like I just said, has been focusing on the issue of campus sexual assault. One of the first bigger stories you did on this subject was about a alleged rape at Florida State. So will you talk a little bit about that story?
Well, I really don't follow college athletics, but there was a lot of news coverage of an allegation against a future Heisman Trophy winner, Jameis Winston, at Florida State. I was up in New York following that coverage and listened to the prosecutor say that he did not have enough evidence to pursue a criminal case against Mr. Winston. But he also hinted that the police hadn't done all that it should have done in its investigation. And that intrigued me. And I thought, well, you know, my experience is prosecutors usually don't criticize the police because they need the police and to help them build other cases. So I thought it was worth a risk, the expense of going down and talking to the prosecutor after all the media left town. And in the quiet moments, you know, weeks later, you know, I walked in there and talked to him, and he indicated that there were very serious shortcomings. And that got me started. There was also the sports editor at the paper had suggested that I take a look as well. So while I had an interest in the topic already, you know, there was a little extra motivation because he asked me to look into it for me to go down. And that's really how I started. My approach to these stories is, you know, coming in late after the fact, I don't go in there to try and establish whether a rape happened or didn't happen. I don't know whether Mr. Winston's telling the truth or his accuser's telling the truth. And my stories made no effort to answer that question. My stories are important because they looked at how the institutions responded to that complaint. Did they behave appropriately? Did they follow the law? Did they do what they should have done? So that was my goal in that story and in other stories that I've done. Was the response by officials, by the school, by the police, by the district attorney, you know, was that response proper?
So you mentioned earlier you try not to focus on topics that everyone else is covering in a moment. And looking at your body of work, this one did stick out because it seems you were investigating it while so many other stories were coming out. And you said that the sports editor encouraged you, but what also made you want to investigate this story and why was it important enough?
Because I felt that there were a lot of unanswered questions. I mean, there may have been a media, you know, scrum down there. Media flocked from around the country to Tallahassee to cover this story, but then they all left. And I didn't feel that they had probed the reasons for the prosecutor to say that the police had not done enough. And I just thought that, well, with everybody gone, their focus is elsewhere. I can go down there and quietly start digging around. And that's what I did. And you're right. It's not typical of me to pick a story that has been on the front pages already. But I thought this was worth it and that was an opportunity for an investigative reporter to come down there and do some serious digging.
And explain how your reporting was different. You've said earlier you try to focus on institutions, and this story very much looks at the Tallahassee Police Department. So compared to the other stories about this specific case, explain what made yours different.
Well, the police hadn't done a good job, and prosecutors said that, but I wanted to know more. And, you know, what did they not do? And I studied all the records that I could. I filed open records requests, and that was the beginning. I wanted to tell the story of what happened after the report got made, after the accusation was passed on in a detailed way, which hadn't been done. So I thought it was interesting that there had been virtually no police investigation whatsoever of a felony rape accusation. Why? I thought that was an important question to ask.
And you've been reporting campus sexual assault in the last few years, which we've also seen some bad reporting come out of this topic, specifically the Rolling Stone article on the UVA rape allegation, which basically, I mean, frankly, it was lazy reporting is what came out later. Will you talk about covering a subject along with other people and the comparisons that can be drawn when you're in the middle of covering something a lot of other people are?
Well, I try and just follow my own guidelines and my own standards, and others will follow their own standards. I don't think the reporter at Rolling Stone set out to turn out a bad story. I think she was under a lot of pressure to produce something that would be distinctive and go beyond what others had reported. And I don't think her editors served her well. It was thinly sourced. There were a lot of red flags. And unfortunately, that story set back the cause for a lot of others, reporters, because, you know, it led to an unfair generalization that other stories reporting rape accusation had been done in a similar sloppy fashion, which, you know, wasn't always true.
So you also covered a rape allegation at a school in New York State, which was very similar but also very different from the Florida State one, because in this case you focused on the university and how they handled it. And some of the, just reading the story, it's pretty shocking how the university reacted. Will you talk about that case and your story around that allegation?
I was able to obtain the secret transcript of the student disciplinary hearing, which was really an unusual feat. I mean, they don't release these. It's the privacy laws. I was able to get a hold of it. And
through a whistleblower or something like that?
I'm not going to tell you how I got a hold of it. But what it did is it laid bare the problems that existed in that university in terms of inexperienced hearing officers asking poorly worded questions, confusing questions, silly questions that frankly made no sense whatsoever. And I was able to quote them and tell this young lady's story without reaching a judgment as to who was telling the truth. I was able to show that the boy she accused had lied, initially lied about having no sexual contact with her. I was able to report, I mean, I reported what I was able to find, and again, without reaching judgments, but focusing not on the act itself as much as the response by the university to this accusation. And it turned out to be quite a powerful story that probably had more reaction than any story I've done.
Both of the stories you've done about sexual assault at universities focus, or the accused as an athlete. And so I'm curious, when you were reporting these stories, did you look at other cases at that university? And was that one example of how the police or how the university treated any type of allegation of this kind? Or was it specific to when there was an athlete involved?
Well, I thought it was important for me to look at other cases. Mm-hmm. And in Florida State, I did just that. I looked at other, you know, accusations by Florida State women that they had been raped, and I wanted to know how the police down there had responded. And I found a pattern of cases, really, where the police didn't seem too interested in pursuing these cases. In some instances, appeared to me to be actively discouraging the young women from pursuing cases. You know, it's hard to prove a rape case. Usually there's only two people. And absent physical evidence, it's a tough case to make. Even if there are honest, sincere investigators and prosecutors, that doesn't mean they shouldn't be investigated. And I think what I was finding is that, well, these are tough cases. I don't want to get involved in it. I'll probably not be able to make it. You know, I'll just tell I don't know this. I can't read their minds, but this is what a reasonable person might conclude looking at the records, that they might be saying, look, you know, do you really want to do this? You know, you know, it's going to be a long time. You know, and so what they're doing is they're saying factual issues. Yeah, it's a tough road. It's a tough thing to do to pursue a case like this. But I think the motivation in the minds of some people is that they just didn't want to get involved in it, and they wanted it to go away.
And this is something that we're still very much in the middle of in terms of campus sexual assault and how we address them. You know, as a reporter, having seen all of this firsthand, what's been your takeaway on this issue? And do you ever feel hopeless when it keeps happening and there's no change?
Well, I never feel hopeless. I'm optimistic that, you know, good reporting will produce good results. And there has been change. There's been change in Tallahassee. There's been change in at the small university where I reported the other case that we've discussed. So there has been change. Has there been enough? Probably not. But, you know, change comes in increments. Sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back. But I do think that this issue of campus sexual assault has been placed firmly in the public consciousness over the last year for two reasons. Courageous women deciding to speak out and tell their stories, and reporters interested in digging into these stories. And universities have responded positively, many of them. Others haven't, but hopefully they will. So I have seen some good results, but there's a long way to go.
And you just mentioned, I mean, this is a tough issue for a reporter to dig into. In general, when doing stories like this and big investigative pieces, you know, what are your rules as an investigative reporter to correctly and accurately tell a story like this?
Well, accuracy and fairness is what we're all about. If we can't do that, we should do something else. That's our goal in every story we do. You have to have integrity. You know, you start with a hypothesis and you prove it or disprove it, and you have to be honest. And it's your own personal moral code, and you should have input from your editors, and I have very good editors. So collectively, we make a judgment that we've been thorough, that we've been fair, that we've been accurate, and that we fulfilled our mission. And when we do that, we know we've done our job, and what happens, happens.
And this is a little bit of a shift, but having done part of your career in TV and a big chunk of it doing print writing, but the investigative principles seem to be the same for you. What were the challenges of switching mediums? Or I've noticed, too, the New York Times has really built up its digital platforms. And so your stories in the last few years seem to include so much more interaction online. I mean, does that change your job at all, or how you approach a story when you also have to get video and things like that for the web and online?
I love what's happening these days at the New York Times, because I do have an interest in the visual medium, and I love it. And I love the collaborative aspect of working in television or with videographers and photographers and graphics people. And we've recognized that on the web there are magical things we can do with creative people. And we're filled with creative people at the Times. And it's an exciting era to be working in. So it does complicate the reporting process. Having a camera there, there are many moving parts, way more than there used to be, but the end result is one that produces a fuller account of whatever issue you're investigating, and it's fun, and one of the main reasons that long form journalism is going to survive. Because there are ways to make it interesting and to allow people to read from beginning to end, a reason to read from beginning to end. So, yes, there's some important new developments, and I like them.
I think the Florida State web story on the New York Times is a great example of that, because you can listen to the 911 call. There's a timeline running down to show when they went back and interviewed people. And it as a reader, it really enhanced and helped me move through this long story, because you can stop and you can listen to the 911 call. You can read the police report. And I just thought it was really interesting the way you use the digital tools you have available at the New York Times to tell that story. You know, what else have you gotten to do in terms of enhancing your reporting with digital things?
Well, we have these incredibly creative people who are able to make these digital images and to work, use data in a way that goes way beyond just tables of numbers. You know, I don't know all that they do or how they do it. All I know is when I read it and look at it, it's really impressive. And when I worked at network television, one of the most frustrating aspects of that is I didn't feel that I had the opportunity to lay out my evidence for the conclusions that we were reaching. There were several interviews, and that was it. Now, in print at the Times, you can have links to all the documents that you're using or embed these videos in the actual pieces themselves, as you pointed out. I think it's a fuller, richer way to present a story.
And so what are you working on now? I mean, have you moved away from the campus sexual assault stories that you've been doing the last few years? Have you tried to attack something else, or are you still in the middle of that?
I don't talk about stories I'm working on. Now, otherwise somebody else is going to do them. So that will be my secret.
Fair enough. We've been talking with Walt Bogdanich, investigative reporter for the New York Times. Walt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found at our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios of Indiana University. James Gray is the producer. The studio engineer and radio audio director is Michael Paskash. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles.